For the week of March 16th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 229, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York at the Zoe Foundation for the Arts, I'm Michael Giltz.
Okay, do we need to... Zoe Foundation for the Arts? What is that?
That's my friend's apartment where I'm stealing her Wi-Fi.
Okay, does she know you're stealing her Wi-Fi?
She does. She doesn't know I've unplugged her fridge because it's so noisy.
Okay, so what you're saying is we have to record this show very quickly so that her ice cream doesn't melt.
That's right. Actually, I haven't unplugged her fridge. I just moved to another part of the apartment. Don't worry, Zoe, your ice cream is safe.
Okay, well, you know, before we really get into this week's show, let's do some programming notes for upcoming episodes.
Oh, this is a news to me, people. Uh-huh. Yes, Sperling?
You're hearing
yes.
it live
When are you
here.
Letting people down?
Well, I am letting people down next week, but really I'm not letting them down. I'm just doing some research in Las Vegas. Now, that might sound like I'm not doing much research at all, but actually next week in Las Vegas is the annual conference CinemaCon, and that is the largest conference and largest trade show for movie theater owners in the world. So,
wouldn't a real journalist report live from CinemaCon?
You know, a lot of real journalists do, but and I will be on Celluloid Junkie. Just, you know, it's very difficult to bring an entire studio with you to a Las Vegas trade show.
All right. So no show next week.
No show next week, but you can always subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, the Microsoft Marketplace, the Google Play Store, wherever they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to our show, or you can follow us on Twitter. Our username is @ShowbizSandbox. It's the same on Facebook, where our username is @ShowbizSandbox, or it's not @ShowbizSandbox, but our page can be found if you search for Showbiz Sandbox. All of this information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com, and that's also where you'll find ways to email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
That's right. So no show next week because Sperling doesn't love you.
That does not sound as good the way you put it.
That's okay, Sperling. You just go have fun in Vegas. Leave us here all alone in the dark. But before 2 weeks from now, when you come back, when you're ready, what are we going to do at least this week on the show?
Well, on today's show, we're going to be joined by members of the Family Crest, which is a fast-rising band who is just back from the annual South by Southwest Festival, which came to an end in Austin, Texas this past week. I've wanted to do this for a long time, to talk to a band that was selected to play South by Southwest and went and played. They're going to tell us what it was like to be at South by Southwest this year, and maybe more importantly, what it's like to play the festival, especially as one of the hotter acts.
What I like more about the Family Crest is that they're a band that seems to just be like completely modern. They are like a collective. They reached people via Craigslist, and they had a Kickstarter campaign for their albums. They have their songs placed on ads. They're just doing all the modern things that bands do. Used to want radio play and be on MTV. Now it's like, I want an ad.
Right, exactly. It's the exact opposite of the 1960s. Exactly. Right. Well, during Inside Baseball, we're going to review some of the Broadway shows, Michael, that you said last year you would have invested in, and find out how they fared. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines, as we always do. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz. You're going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And the number one movie around the world, according to RentTrack, is that meth-dealing kid from Breaking Bad. It's Need for Speed, starring Aaron Paul. It grossed $63 million around the world. That's basically its budget, so that's a pretty good start. It had not a great start in North America. It was beaten for the weekend by both Mr. Peabody and Sherman and 300 Rise of an Empire, and it only made $17 million. But overseas, it did quite well. It made about $45 million, so $63 million total. It's about a $66 million budget. Who knows how it'll do long term, but that's always nice to make your budget back in the first weekend.
Yeah, it's being considered a bit of a disappointment here in the U.S., and you know it's a disappointment here in the U.S. when Dave Hollis, the head of distribution at Disney, is kind of going, "Yeah, we're not thrilled at the response." Normally, you know, the interviews on Sunday afternoons with the heads.
We found our niche audience, and we know it's going to expand and reach more people.
Yeah, wait until next week. Oh, we're not going to lose money. But when you have Dave Hollis, you know, or one of these executives say, "Yeah, well, we could have done better."
It's distributed by Disney, but it is one of the final films at DreamWorks from Stacy Snyder, right?
Well, yes, there's a whole big to-do about that. I found out a little bit more information about that over the weekend, and that is that the way Steven Spielberg found out about Stacey Snyder's interest in moving to Fox was via The Hollywood Reporter.
No, that's not true, because there's been like well over a year of mumblings about her leaving and wanting to go somewhere else. So, you know, that's just silly.
Well, I agree. I said the same thing to the folks who told me this, and they said, well, look, you know, when you're Steven Spielberg and directors and filmmakers and celebrities like, you know, people on that par, you're not always listening to the scuttlebutt, and people aren't necessarily telling you that information. But
he does see the New York Times and the Hollywood Reporter Variety, I assume.
Right, precisely.
So it should have been on his radar well over a year ago that she wanted to leave, making fewer and fewer movies, smaller and smaller budgets. Look at this thing. This is a modest, you know, up or down on Need for Speed. Whether it does that well or that poorly, who cares? It's like a B movie.
Right,
she's reduced to making B movies.
But I will say that because of the way DreamWorks is structured, you know, a Need for Speed is being released by Disney here in the U.S. by, you know, but not necessarily overseas. So, you know, maybe
that doesn't. But she doesn't care. It's a success for her worldwide. It's a success. I can't even say the word. If it's a hit, it's a hit. She doesn't care whether one particular country doesn't do right. Overall, Need for Speed looks like it might be a decent success unless it collapses. So there you go. She made a B movie. It doesn't matter how big or little of a hit it is. It's like it's not going to be that big or that small a movie no matter what. So, you know, it's a B movie. If it makes it, fine. If it doesn't, it won't lose much money for most people, whatever.
Exactly. That's where I was headed with that.
Right, so she's just whatever. You know, she's making movies that nobody even really cares about. Sorry, Aaron Paul, I like you. All right, so that's Need for Speed, the number one movie around the world, according to RentTrack. Number two is 300, Rise of an Empire, made another $60 million. It's at $236 million worldwide. At number three is Mr. Peabody and Sherman, which made another $36 million. It's at $150 million worldwide. It rose to number one this weekend at the box office, so that was a good success story for the film. It only dropped about 35% in North America. It's the number one film in the country. It has, well, I know Rio 2 is coming up in a few weeks. I think there's some other family film coming up soon that it has to fight off. I forget what that is, but, you know, it's got a week or two, I think, of, you know, I mean, Divergent comes out next week. Whether that competes with Mr. Peabody and Sherman is an open question. But, you know, it's got some time. It's got a little breathing room to try and establish itself and make its money and not be, you know, a flop. But, you know, $300 million worldwide still looks like a fairly reasonable proposition for this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder what the Stern AG analyst Vasily Karas, you know what, I couldn't pronounce his name last week. Why would I try and pronounce it again this week? That's just stupid of me. But Vasily Karasyov, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly this time, he's the analyst at Stern AG that said, oh my goodness, you know, this film is eventually going to have to earn $310 million, or DreamWorks Animation is going to have to
take it. And it's still going to lose $80 million.
Yeah, they're going to have to take a huge write down on this. Well, maybe not.
Well, you know, I still think, you know, he's at a 150. It may very well end up at 300. That sounds not so unreasonable. But yet again, if you're going to look at the future stock performance of a company, why are you looking at the last four films? Why aren't you looking at the next five films? And I don't think you can say a company's broken because it tried to launch four franchises and one of them hit. That's The Cruise. One of them was a wash. That's Turbo. And two didn't do great. Well, I mean, what do you think is going to happen? If you look at all those four films and all the money they bring in, not just worldwide box office, just like when we say, hey, it's silly to look at just North America or just Europe or just Australia. You know, you wouldn't look at just one market. You look at the worldwide box office for a movie to see how it's doing at the box office. For final profitability of a film, you don't just look at box office. You look at DVD and Blu-ray and video on demand and streaming and selling it to cable and television for reruns and selling, you know, satellite services. You got to look at the whole pie. And if you look at all that, those last four films will make them money and they've launched a franchise. So you make four movies, four attempts to hit a franchise. One of them clicks. You don't lose any money. That's a pretty good day at the bank. And number four around the world is Nonstop, the Liam Neeson action film, $23 million. It's at $130 million worldwide. At number five, I don't know how to say her name. How do you say her name?
Adele Dazeem.
Thank you. She stars in Frozen. It made another $12 million. $1,026 million, and Disney is still counting and still happy.
Yes, they could not be happier, no pun in. Well, no, I guess happy was the song from.
No, that's sort of a nice dig, you know. Yeah,
they are probably delighted that John Travolta messed up Idina Menzel's name during the Oscars.
Well, I went to a show, a theater show, and met a woman who's in marketing. And she feels like that screw-up actually sold tickets for Idina Menzel's new Broadway show, If Then.
That's right.
She's like, well, it helps. It brings publicity. I go, but do you really think someone bought a ticket who wouldn't have otherwise? Well, and she's backed off that a little bit. But, you know, all publicity is good publicity. Everybody's talking about Idina Menzel. Plus, of course, her link to Frozen. She stars in the new Broadway show, If Then. It's doing very well at the box office.
Along with Anthony Rapp, I might add.
That's quite true. Yes. Big star of Rent.
Yes.
All right. So she's gotten, you know, a banner year for Idina. So number six is the Lego movie, another $12 million. That's $378 million. That's a lot of plastic pieces. And number seven is the Grand Budapest Hotel, $10 million. It's opening wider overseas pretty quickly. It's made $25 million so far. In North America, it broke into the top 10, even though it's only playing on 66 screens. It had a 55,000 per screen average on 60. If that was one screen, that'd be pretty good. So the Grand Budapest Hotel is really rocking it out here in North America. They have to be very excited about its prospects when it goes wider. That's from Fox Searchlight. Another movie also broke into the top 10 in North America on just a few screens, and that is Veronica Mars. It's way down on this list at $2 million. It wouldn't even make the worldwide top 20, you know, as far as like grosses at the box office. But in North America, it hit the top 10. It's on 291 screens. Other than Grand Budapest Hotel, other than movies on very limited screens, anything over 100 screens, Veronica Mars had the best per screen average, about $7,000 per screen. It made $2 million. People weren't sure if it would make $10.
Right. And I would like to defend this because a lot of people are saying, oh, it's such an iffy opening.
No, it's not.
It was on 291 screens.
And it was available on video on demand. And the biggest fans were handed free digital copies of the movie. The people who were the most passionate fans.
Well, that wasn't free. They paid to.
But that was a year ago. Yeah, that doesn't include it in the box office. I mean, yeah, it made $2 million at the box office and fans handed over $5 million in advance just to see it get made. So in a way, it's a $7 million opening weekend for a movie that cost $6 million to make.
Yeah, and I agree. And it was on 291 screens with, here was their advertising budget, zero. They basically advertised on the internet. That was it. There was no huge television blitz.
Not even. Was there a single ad? I don't know.
No, there was not. They purposefully said, we are not advertising on television. We're not advertising in print. There are zero billboards. We are advertising online.
We're paying to put it in theaters. They're renting the theaters. How much would that cost for walling it?
Figure at least $10,000 a week per screen. So $2.9 million is what 291 times 10,000? That's what? $291,000?
$1,000 would be $291,000. So $10,000 would be $2.9 million.
Right. So they're about to break
even.
So
they lost money. They lost $1 million.
Yes, although not really, because remember, this is just the first 3 days. They got
another 4 days. Yeah, but they're not going to make a lot more. They need to make $900,000 just to break even during the week.
Yeah. Well, again, that was an estimate. That was my
I don't
estimate.
Know what it cost a four wall. Maybe they got some bargain deal. I mean, in this day and age with a digital print and movie theaters having such ability to expand and contract their space, who knows what the deal was. But, you know, if the studio can not lose money and put it out on DVD and Blu-ray and make money, you know, who knows? It's sort of a big PR campaign for the DVD release, isn't it?
Yes. Well, and I've heard it suggested that this release of Veronica Mars in theaters, the theatrical release, is really just a make good on the Kickstarter campaign. And I think as Rob Thomas, the showrunner, and did he direct this? I guess he did direct.
Yeah.
He's the creator of Veronica Mars. He said, you know, he will not be returning to Kickstarter to do his future efforts. And a part of that is the fulfillment.
Well, they didn't need to promise that. That was stupid anyway. They didn't need to promise that they were going to give him a digital copy the day the movie hit theaters, if it ever did. They could have just said, hey, we'll give you a Blu-ray or DVD when it comes out on, you know, on that format.
Right. And I think they learned their lesson on that. But I think for Rob Thomas and everybody associated with this.
It's a lot of work. It's a pain.
Yeah. Fulfillment is not easy. And they learned that firsthand. I don't know.
Oh, that's right. There was a little kerfuffle about some people. My friends had invested. They got a digital copy. Everything went smoothly. There were some people online who said they had trouble when they were trying to download the movie. And this is because they were sticking with one particular, you know, some people want, hey, why can't I get it via Amazon? Why can't I get it via iTunes? They were only making it available via Ultraviolet, correct?
Right. They were making it available via Flixster. And remember, Veronica Mars is a Warner Brothers title. It's a Warner Brothers property. And Flixster is also a Warner Brothers property, so they were trying to kind of...
So some people who'd never used it before had to download it, and they were having problems.
Yeah.
I assume they figured it all out. I don't know. My friends got it easily enough. If 10 people have a problem, it's a news story. So I don't know how many people... It was enough for them to post on the website and say, hey, we're sorry some people are having trouble downloading the movie. And eventually they'll get it, but obviously they want it the day it's out.
Right.
That's the whole point. So, I mean, that's certainly no fun. Yeah, this is why, again, we're going to get to the family crest later, why no matter how much success you have as a self-published author or self-published musician or self-published movie maker, it's nice sometimes to have the structure and support of a company like a film company, a record label, or, you know, a TV network.
Yes.
So that Veronica Mars is definitely a fascinating, fascinating issue here in North America. Again, like the Grand Budapest Hotel, it broke into the top 10 on very few screens. And number 8 around the world is George Clooney's The Monuments Men, $10 million. It's at $130 million and counting. It needs to keep counting in order to get to profitability. And number 9, another movie that opened in North America only and probably will never open anywhere else in the world. It's Tyler Perry's The Single Moms Club. It made $8.3 million. It was one of the lowest opening weekends for a Tyler Perry movie in ages, which brings up the question, Sperling.
It wasn't one of the, it was the lowest.
It's the lowest of all time, including the first Madea? All right. Well, the question is, did Lionsgate drop the ball on marketing this movie because they were ending their contract with Tyler Perry? They decided not to renew. Or did Lionsgate decide not to renew with Tyler Perry because they felt like he dropped the ball creatively and was running out of steam?
I think an argument could be made
for Bob, both. What are you, a predator
however,
for office?
However, I would say that it's probably the latter.
Oh, I don't think so.
Okay, well.
But it's possible. You know,
I well, think you could really make an argument that Tyler Perry decided not to re-up with.
No, this movie was important to him. It was based on a family member's life story, etc. So, but I just think anyway, you're an idiot if you think, well, we're running out of steam, our contract's ending, we don't think much of his movie. You're still leaving money on the table. Why wouldn't you do everything you could to promote it as always so you can make your money?
Right.
You know, you're just being short-sighted. Just like when a new studio head comes in and says, oh, I don't want to promote that movie because the last guy greenlit it. So what? Make money.
Yeah.
At number 10 is 12 Years a Slave, $7 million, $171 million worldwide. It's all gravy from this point on out for the Oscar winner. At number 11, RoboCop, that's at $235 million. At number 12, another movie that has not been released overseas. It's only in North America and probably will only be in North America. I don't know. It's Son of God. It made $5 million. It's hit $50 million for a re-edited, shortened version of a miniseries that's already out on DVD.
What I think is interesting is that, here you have Veronica Mars with movie theaters saying, we don't want to show that because you're releasing it the same day and date, as it's called, on digital
right.
and DVD and via, you know what?
But so, Son of God,
it's
already been seen on TV. It's out on DVD in a longer, more complete version. But, oh, hey, sure, bring it on.
Let's put it on 3,500 screens.
Can you imagine if they took the final two episodes of the upcoming season of The Walking Dead and turned it into a movie and added a couple scenes of, head slashing and, nails, spikes in the forehead and chopping off of arms just for, added bonus feed. Can you imagine if they added that and made it into a movie and put it in theaters? Do you think it would make $50 million? Not a chance in hell.
Yeah, I would agree.
I guess chance in hell is very appropriate since we're talking about Christians versus zombie lovers.
Right, but it's also Son of God is on a heck of a lot more screens, and I would like to point out
a heck of a lot more screens than what? The Walking Dead?
It's on 100% more screens. It's 2009.
That Walking Dead's not released.
No,
I'm saying if you release The Walking Dead, do you think it would make $50 million at the box? Do you think it makes $5 million at the box office? I don't.
Forget about The Walking Dead for a second. Okay?
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, I'm talking about the fact that you have two television properties in movie theaters right now.
One is original and one is just a regurgitation.
Right. The regurgitation is on 2,990 screens.
And they didn't blink an eye. Exactly. They're just being short-sighted. They think, oh my God, if we allow them to do this with Veronica Mars, that's the end of the world. But Son of God, they don't think, uh-oh.
Yeah, and I point out, just to end the Veronica Mars debate here, I knew people who really wanted to see Veronica Mars in theaters and still want to. However, it's only on 291 screens, and they couldn't go this weekend.
There's a lot of cities where it's not available.
Exactly. And
I mean, it's on like 5 or 10 screens in New York City. It's on a fair amount here, so that's, now you're down to 270, 280.
Right. So that said, I think, people who pointed at Veronica Mars and say, gee, it didn't work, You know what? It worked just fine.
But you know why they're not going to take The Walking Dead and take the last two episodes and put them in movie theaters? Because they'd be afraid of ruining the brand for the next season. If it was a miniseries or something, maybe they'd look at what happened with the Bible, which has been turned into Son of God, and say, hey, why not? You know, it's worth a shot. It's free money. Well, who knows? We'll never find out. A couple new movies have hit screens around the world. One of them is Fiston, or Son, I think. It's a French sex comedy starring Kev Adams, which has to be the least French-sounding name I've ever heard.
He sounds like a frat boy. Hey, Kev!
In Spain, there's a comedy called Ocho Apellidos Vascos, or I think Eight Basque Surnames. That stars Danny Rivera and Clara Lago. South Korea, there's Elegant Lies, a very serious drama about a 14-year-old girl who commits suicide. Her single mom and sister don't know why, and then they found out she was being bullied. It's like the whole world decided we're going to start paying attention to bullying. And down in Mexico, there is The Crime of Cacara Gumaro, which I think is about two brothers. Watching the trailer in Spanish, I think it's about two brothers who take over a movie theater in a small town and maybe start filming their own movies to show there. I'm not quite sure what the twist is, but it's two guys operating a movie theater in a small town. Looks like a nice broad comedy. Those have all made a couple million dollars in their home territories. None of them look huge, but they're doing They're doing okay. And maybe we'll be hearing about them down the road, just like Fußball, which was that Argentinian comedy we talked a lot about, that had done very well in its territory. We talked about it when it came out and the money it was making, and it was like the most expensive, I think, animated film ever from Argentina. Well, the Weinsteins just bought it.
They're
going to bring it to North America, and they're renaming it Underdogs, I guess because they don't think we know what Fußball is. What's wrong with Fußball?
Underdog.
Underdogs is generic. Fußball, I know what Fußball is. It's all about Fußball characters coming to life.
Well, so, we haven't seen that this year already. I think they called that The Lego Movie.
No. It was out before The Lego Movie. It was a big hit. I'm sure it's nothing like The Lego Movie.
But here's the thing. The Lego Movie, also about toys, right? At least those things can,
so is Toy Story.
So is Toy Story. But they can, like, move around.
So is Raggedy Ann and Andy.
What is the foosball folks going to do? What, are they going to run around with the stick through their back?
I think they'll pull out the metal pole, and then they can get around a little bit, you know? Well, you know, so I assume that the Weinsteins will release it someday, though they're famous for buying properties and sitting on them. You know, maybe if they're going to release Fußball, maybe someday they could get around to re-releasing the South Korean drama Snowpiercer, because we're still waiting to see that one here.
That's right. Now, aren't they going to re-edit that?
Of course they're going to. I'm sure they'll cut 20 minutes out of Fußball. It's what they do. So that's the box office around the world. Oh, and towards the bottom is The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, $2.3 million. It just opened up in Japan. I don't know if our figures include its opening weekend in Japan. It made, I think, like $3 million or $3.5 million, something like that. And its opening weekend in Japan, it was doing better than the last one. But all things considered, I think it's going to fall just short of $1 billion. It's at $943 million for the second of three Hobbit films.
You know, my daughter's favorite present from her ninth birthday, which was recently, is the Hobbit Desolation of Smaug Lego set. Loves it. She's very happy. She has not one, not two, but three rings. They provide three rings inside this kit, you know, in case you lose one, I suppose.
Three rings to rule them all. Three rings to find them. Three rings to bring them all. And in the darkness, bind them in the land of Mordor, where the shadows lie. I don't know. It doesn't have the same ring to it.
You know, Hal Douglas just passed away. The voiceover, he's a legend in the voiceover world for movie trailers, and I think maybe we found his replacement.
Oh, if only. I'd love it. I've got the body for it. And I could maybe have the body for a rock star. I mean, if you're going to have 100 people on stage, it wouldn't matter if I was in the background shaking a tambourine, would it?
Probably not. Well, maybe. I don't know. I've always, you know, if I was ever going to be a rock star, it's probably with the Family Crest that I could do it. In fact, I probably missed my chance because the Family Crest is an indie rock band. I guess we can call them an indie rock band. They were just at South by Southwest, which took place in Austin, Texas. Takes place every year in March in Austin, Texas. I've always wanted to go, but it's always up against CinemaCon or Show West. And joining us from the band is Liam McCormick. Liam, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you are the lead singer, lead guitarist. How would you describe your role in the Family Crest?
I write the music, and I sing and play guitar. That's generally it. Band leader, I guess.
But now, you started the band back in 2008, if I'm not mistaken?
it was kind of going on in my head for a while. And in 2008, we decided to make the record. And the record was essentially just kind of some kind of musical output for John and I, my bass player. And at the time, we didn't plan on even releasing the music as a band. And the extended family, the people that we now call the extended family, all the different players that come and play with us, they all asked when they were going to be able to see it live. And we were like, oh, you want to join a band then? And we expected everyone, you know, we kind of said it sarcastically. And everybody was like, yeah, let's do it. So, so the band formed in 2008. I guess it was more 2009 when the band formed. And it was a very slow process collecting members. And we released our first record in 2010.
Well, and you're from San Francisco, so the band is based in San Francisco. It's got seven core members, and what I love is the way it's described, seven core members with several hundred additional members. And that's not, I'm not misspeaking, it's several hundred additional members. When you go to the website for the Family Crest, there's literally pages of additional members.
Yeah, it's the best part of the band for me. You know, as a writer, you're constantly having to, in this kind of a project, you have to constantly learn and adapt and learn how to write for different instruments. And so by having that open door policy, at least for me, it enables me to write for everything, which is sometimes scary, but it's really a fun thing. They're all great. They're amazing.
Well, sure. I mean, and, you know, Canada has been known for these sort of collectives, these bands that seem to be bursting with people on stage, you know, like 20 people. I mean, you're like, no, we're in America. We can do it even bigger than that. We're going to have 100 people. How many people have you had on stage at one time ever? What's the most?
You know what? That we haven't. I think the most was either 16 or 18.
You got to do better than that.
That's right.
Let everybody be in the audience, like, you know, like one of those old The Cradle Will Rock theatrical plays, and have them all perform from the audience on one show. Just, you know, have the whole show be the band, everybody. But anyway, what I love about your group is that it really is, you can see the changes in the music industry by how you guys have gained some visibility, gained some fans. You know, you reached out to those people via Craigslist, everything from flyers to Craigslist and other social media. That's how you reached out to people. And then when you talk about the success points in your group and the evolution of the band, I mean, it used to be in the 60s or 70s, you'd be like, oh, we got added to this radio station, or, oh, you know, we got to do open for this larger act. And today, very, very realistically, one of your big things is getting a song on a TV show. You know, one of your songs, North, was played on the NBC drama Awake. Then you had some songs that were used in ad campaigns, which, you know, used to be things that bands would kind of be like, oh, no, I'm too cool. Now that really is a way to reach people. That's, you know, like being played on the radio used to be. That's how you get attention. That's how people can hear and be exposed to your music. So it's kind of a funny thing. You're like, yeah, we got an ad. But that's really kind of how it works, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, I recently did an interview in another magazine where they asked me about that. And there's the giant question mark, I think, for artists that is selling out. You know what I mean? That's like a big statement that everyone throws around. And to me, I've always felt like selling out happens when you can afford not to sell out and you sell out.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that bands, you know, people don't realize how expensive it is to be in a band. Like they assume, actually, most people assume that, you know, you're just a bunch of losers that, like, you know, you spend all your money on booze and drugs and you're sitting in a van all day. And it's not the case. I mean, like, besides the fact that you're sitting in a van all day.
That's how it works for podcasters.
Exactly. There you go. Those damn podcasters. But yeah, I mean, for us, you know, we're out on the road a lot. And I mean, putting out a record, just the mixing alone is thousands of dollars. And so anytime we can get a little bit of support in that regard, it's awesome. And you get a lot of, nowadays, because of things like, with things like Shazam, I mean, having ads out there and whatnot actually is extremely beneficial, because that's kind of how you get your fans. The hardest part, I think, in the industry right now is that it's become very single based, because you can buy a single versus an entire record. And so, you know, for us, we wanted to make sure that when we put out our record, the entire record could stand up to the single as well, you know. And so we kind of orchestrated the record to be a giant piece of its own, almost like, you know, a classical symphony or something.
Well, and it is very symphonic. I mean, there's, yeah, I think the first song, Beneath the Brine, which is the title track on your upcoming record. When is your record released?
We actually just released it February 23rd.
Okay. So it's out now. And I guess I ran across your music both on Bandcamp, on SoundCloud. And I heard Bob Boylan play it, who's been a guest here on the show. He played it on All Songs Considered. You were also featured on Weekend Edition on February 24th, so right after the album was released. What is it, when you're featured on All Songs Considered or on NPR, what does that do for a band such as The Family Crest? I mean, do you see a bump in sales or a bump in...
Oh, definitely. I mean, to... On a personal level, I grew up listening to NPR, and so did the rest of our band. And so, you know, on a personal level, what it does for us is it makes us feel fantastic. But on a professional level, yeah, it's great exposure. I think our music is very in line with what a lot of the NPR audience listens to in general, or is wanting to listen to. So yeah, it definitely helps a lot. Just to get your name out there. I mean, shows like this help a lot as well. You know, it's just a vein to the public for bands to be able to kind of tell them who we are.
Well, I wonder what conservative bands, and there must be some of them, you know, right-wing political bands, what do they grow up thinking about? I hope I get played on Sean Hannity's radio show, because that just doesn't happen as much.
Oh, so bad. Oh, yeah. we've dreamed of that moment for years.
But so you've signed with a label. It's called Tender Loving Empire.
Tender Loving Records.
I'm sorry, Tender Loving Records? Is that what it's called?
Actually, it's Tender Loving Empire.
Thank you very much. You're wrong again, Sperling. It's a Portland independent label. Tell us why you decided to do that. I don't even know if you dream about signing with a big label. Why did you do that rather than, say, self-releasing the earlier stuff? Is it because there is a lot of work in getting an album out, especially in independent record stores, that is hard to do if you don't want to just be digital? You know, you kind of want that partnership to help make that happen?
Yeah, I mean... For us, we'd been doing it with our first EP and our first record for, I think, 2 years at that point. And I read a lot of different music magazines and spend a lot of time like looking at the scene and stuff. And I noticed that there were very, very, if not any, there are very few bands that were even reviewed or considered in magazines or press in any regard until they were on a label. You know, I mean, I opened up Spin magazine every month and never saw an unsigned band being reviewed. And so it kind of dawned on me that if we really wanted to go to that next level, you need somebody backing you that essentially gives the rest of the industry a little bit of, you know, they have a little clout, and the rest of the industry can kind of look at it and be like, oh, okay. Obviously that's not always the case, but it was, when we went out there, it was extremely important for us to kind of find a team that we felt comfortable with. And they were the guys that just kind of nailed it out of the park with their, what they said about us and what they wanted to do with us. And so, yeah, it was a great decision for us. They're a wonderful, wonderful group of people, and they're very encouraging, and yeah, they're great.
Well, they liked it when you said, hey, we're self-funding our album via Kickstarter.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I love stuff like that. When Kickstarter first came out, you know, the bands that were coming out and using it and just the companies, I mean, it's such a cool idea to be able to fund something from the start. You know, you kind of become a part of it. And that's kind of how it was with our record. You know, we had 256 members that played on Beneath the Brine, but then we also had hundreds of people that backed Beneath the Brine, and it really becomes their record because it couldn't have been made without them. So there's just this huge family of people that contributed to making sure that the record, you know, could get into stores and could just be heard in general. So it's really cool to be able to see, you know, the people that really want to hear your music.
Well, your first album, The Village, in 2012, was funded on Kickstarter. Was Beneath the Brine also funded on Kickstarter?
Not all of it.
Okay.
But yeah, when we came out originally in 2009, we did the same basic thing where we record a lot of the music ourselves. it kind of started out from a cost perspective. You know, we wanted to record all these instruments, but recording in a studio is generally speaking at least $600 a day. And so if you wanted to record hundreds and hundreds of instruments, it's going to cost hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know what I mean? Which an indie band can't really afford. So John and I started researching, you know, how to build a portable rig and how to go about that. And we built this studio that we could bring into any environment and record in. And so what originally started out as being something that was based on, you know, monetary need turned into this realization that performers and they play better in environments that they're comfortable in. So for me, not everybody's like this, but for me, when I go into a studio, I almost feel nervous because there's kind of a finality to being in a studio.
Yeah. And a ticking clock.
Exactly. You know, and so you're sitting in like a white room, generally speaking, with a microphone in front of you and three people judging you in the, the next room. And you're like, oh my God, how am I going to give a true performance? And, you know, the same thing can be said for any kind of player. And so what we did was we took, you know, me personally, I went into a old 200-year-old church from my hometown that's all wood, and we lit candles, and I did my performance there in the dark, and it really made me a lot more comfortable, and it gave me kind of this, I don't know, there was the right vibe, I guess.
The right, you know, cowboy junkies vibe.
Exactly, exactly. And with our string players, for example, I mean, usually we do all of our string recording in John's parents' house in their living room, mainly because, you know, they can have a beer, they can hang out, they don't, there's no ticking clock. And, you know, we'd much rather be able to hang out with people and have that community element there and knock out two songs rather than, you know, like rushing it and trying to get three or four songs. You know?
And John, by the way, we should mention is John Cederlin, your bass player.
Yeah. Yeah. He and I founded the group together.
And you had played in other bands together with John, if I'm not mistaken. Which apparently I am quite often.
Yeah, no, we played in a band together. John actually was in a few bands before that even. John, what's funny about him is he grew up playing like hardcore punk. I don't even know if it's like metal. It's very, very
speed
dissonant
punk.
Hardcore music. Yeah, kind of. Not even, more in the metal vein. I shouldn't say punk because then he's going to get mad at me. It's definitely metal. But and I grew up kind of doing more of an acoustic singer-songwriter thing. And yeah, we converged and then we decided to start this group.
But it was kind of, from what I've read, it was kind of out of a being disenchanted with your previous efforts and your previous bands.
Well, yeah, we were going to leave music. We were going to go to school and, you know, become something else because
Were you going to become?
Extremely. We were going to become podcasters, basically. You know?
Oh my God, that's the worst.
You know, I'd hate to try and talk you out of that, but
I would.
You're like, what decision, Devin? No, but yeah, we just kind of it's being in a band and being in the music world is very, very difficult and. While there are a lot of things that are amazing, I mean, obviously we love it because we've been doing it for 15 years, it still can get very hard. And when you're in your early to mid 20s, you know, the world feels like a heavy, heavy, heavy thing. And at that point we are just kind of like, oh my God, we're feeling the strain. Like we might lose the rest of our lives. And so we did this recording project and, like I said, didn't expect it to be a band. It was just something to be proud of. And it turned into a band. And here we are now in our almost 30s.
But I wouldn't think any band out there would even think about going into a recording studio. In this day and age, I would think the first money after your instruments would be for recording equipment and to set up some studio in your home and stuff because it's so inexpensive and easy. I would think that would just be the default mechanism that, of course, that's the way you would do it. Who the heck would rent a studio when you could, you know, control it and record whenever you want?
Well, there are different kinds of people, and there are also different kinds of recording. For example, John and I never do drums and bass ourselves, mainly because drum recording is an extremely, extremely precise There are so many precise techniques to getting each drum tone. And not only that, but the amount of recording gear that you need to make a really solid drum recording, unless you're going for something in the 1950s doo-wop vein where you're doing two microphones, which sounds amazing, by the way, if you know how to do it. But it costs thousands and thousands of dollars. I mean, the microphones alone for something, if you want a great recording, are going to cost you $5,000. And so we tend to put our time into recording everything but. So we do when we record, we do a scratch drum bass track. So we kind of go backwards to what a lot of people do. We do drums and bass first, you know, with guitar. And then we overlay the actual guitar. And then we go from there. And at the very end of the project, even after we record vocals sometimes, that's when we lay down the drums and bass in the studio. And mainly, you know, the drums are the most important element in modern music, in my opinion. It's kind of what every single person on the planet can relate to. Everyone like enjoys rhythm. Everyone hits the table, you know, when they're listening to something good. And so the drums need to be really, really solid, and they need to have the most emotion next to the vocals. So, you know, if you have a drummer playing, which a lot of people do, to just guitar, bass and drums at the beginning, and they don't have the spectrum of hearing, you know, everything else in the mix, they might come out a little flat. Versus if they're playing and they have a string section behind them and a horn section and the vocals, they can really get into it. And so Charlie and John go in at the end. But generally speaking, I mean, some people record better in studios in general, you know, some people do better in with that pressure vibe. So I definitely think there's a place for studios. And we've been really fortunate to be able to work in some really great Bay Area studios. I mean, Jay Polici, our master engineer, manages to take, you know, hundreds and hundreds of tracks and make them sound like an organic orchestra, you know. So
let's actually take a quick listen to what some of that sounds like when it's all put together in one song.
The sound, the tick, the weighty click of her heart against my spine. Now the dark is nigh, and she lays here at my side. But like a steady squall, her arms they fall, and her legs they grasp me tight.
Oh. Well, let me ask you, when you're recording, because there's a lot of instruments going on there, and so when you're recording in a church or in somebody's living room, what you're recording into this rig that you built, what is it that you're recording into? Is it a laptop computer? Is it a MacBook? Is it into Logic Pro or Pro Tools? Or,
well, we tend to use Pro Tools. We have a Mac laptop, and we have what's called a DigiDesign 002 unit. It's an old... basically, it's just a preamp, that a digital preamp that you can plug your microphones directly into the box, and that'll feed it into the computer. And then we've always, and up until recently, we've used the same mics on everything. So on every record, we've used, for any gearheads out there, two Neumann TLM 103s for a lot of the strings and the vocals. We've used a few AKG mics on the cello and the bass and the viola. So we have a C1000 and a C2000. And then we were using, and we still own, some fat heads made by Cascade. And they're these ribbon mics that are beautiful, but they're very delicate. And because we travel a lot, we've kind of ruined them, I think. So we have to get some new ones. We actually recently picked up a pair of Josephsons that are unbelievable. So anybody looking to record any guitar or stringed instrument, look for some Josephson C24s. They're ridiculous.
We could find that music on your website where people can stream the music. Are you any, and they can go, it's thefamilycrest.com or what is, yes.
That I can confirm.
And are you on a streaming service like Pandora or Spotify? Are you any of those? Because I know that if you can get a million plays on some place like Pandora or Spotify, you can make up to $50.
Yeah. Well, we are on Pandora. We're definitely on Spotify. And we're at thefamilycrest.net, actually.
Thank you.
Darn.
It's okay. You can cut in that you said net, and then, you know, we'll cut this whole segment and we'll be fine.
But to tell us, do you see the album as just a promotional device for your tours, or do you really like, no, we want people to pay for it and appreciate it and love it, but, you know, we need that money. That's important to us.
To be honest, if you're in the music industry just about the money, then you should get out of the music industry because there's really not that much money. The reason that we started this band still stands. I mean, we're going to be really happy if we can afford to make the next record and the record after that. And so obviously we love for people to go out and buy our record, and it helps us out, not just in a monetary way, but mainly it shows the general public how many people are listening to the music. It shows, you know, sites like Billboard and Rolling Stone, you know, what our listening curve is and how many people like us. And that's what's going to get us out into venues. And for us, you know, the goal is kind of this, it's interesting, you know, when we do a record, obviously the goal is to make something that is beautiful and that you can listen to and enjoy almost like you'd watch a film. It is to make an entire record, you know, and not just a single. But then once the record's done, the goal is, yeah, we want to play as much as humanly possible, and we want to affect people on that level. And so, you know, unless our vehicle breaks down, which it does every day, we'll be in everyone's hometown if we can.
Well, a couple points there. One, the last time I read a story where a vehicle broke down for a band was, I want to say it was Robert Hilburn writing about a small little group at the time in 2004. He helped them push their van as he was kind of following them around for this story through an intersection in Los Angeles, and then, you know, pushed it up to the venue and watched them get their gear out. And then he went to see the Arcade Fire, which was the name of the band. The band started their show at Michael, you might like this, in the audience. So,
there you go.
Yeah. So, and then they went up on stage. But you let a lot of basically anybody who wishes they played an instrument to, you know, a professional musician, anybody can come and join you on one of your shows.
Yeah, literally anybody. We on our record, for example, we have people that have never, like, that I had to convince to be on the record, that had never sang before, that could, oh, I have a terrible voice, I'm tone deaf, blah, blah, blah. You know, and then we also have people that are, you know, in symphonies on the record.
We'll be on the next record. You don't have to convince us.
I would love to have you.
I have a lovely singing voice.
Do you play anything?
No. I'd love to play, you know, I wanted to, but we moved a lot.
Actually, I'll tell you, I was, you've convinced me to pick up my trumpet again, and mainly because I'm going to see your show here in Los Angeles on March 20th, a couple of days from now. And I thought, oh, I should, you know, sign up to be a member of the family. And then I thought, wow, I haven't played the trumpet in a year. That's probably a really bad idea.
No, but you know what? That's actually the extended family, the way it moved. It's changed very different drastically. You know, originally for me, it was just a way to play music with my friends. But over the years, I realized as I was kind of embedded into the classical scene in San Francisco through my band that, you know, a lot of people, hundreds of kids, thousands of kids go to conservatories and music schools or go to high school and play music. And there comes a time when, you know, either after high school, they stop playing and they go do something else, or after college, they can't get a job because there's so few jobs in the music industry, and they put down their instrument, and sometimes they actually put it down because it's heartbreaking to look at it, and they don't even play anymore, you know, and sometimes they just put it down out of necessity. But the point is, there's hundreds and hundreds of people that don't have an outlet to play. And so it has become, I mean, whenever I hear something like your story where, you know, I haven't picked up my instrument for years and now I'm going to pick it up and learn how to play it again, That is what it's about for me. You know, we had the same thing happen with a girl in Portland who hadn't played clarinet since high school. And she was like, you know, she emailed us and was like, I'd love to play with you. So we sent her a song and, the sheet music. And we're like, there's no pressure. You know, it's kind of like whenever you're ready, whenever you want to play, whenever you're confident, then come ask us and we'll do it. And it gives people time. You know, I think that's the other thing. People don't feel like, oh my God, I have to jump on stage for an entire show and play the entire set. They can come up and be like, I want to play one song. I want to be able to practice it for 3 months. And then I want to, you know, when they're in my hometown, play with them live. And it is, it's really, really amazing for us because every show has a different energy and a different color for the audience. So
you're hippies, aren't you?
Well, we're from San Francisco. We're just
exactly.
Kind of, I guess we're like tech hippies.
and a great platform for you, of course, is South by Southwest, which is a great way again to gain credibility, like being signed to an indie label like Tender Loving Empire. Being at South by Southwest is a real badge of honor, and it's very cool. You get a lot of people to be exposed to your music that way. How did you find out about it? How did you get your name in there? Was it being associated with Tender Loving Empire that got you that foot in the door, or being on NPR, or what was it?
You know, I think it's all of the above. We've been out to South By. This is our third time. The first time we went out, we were completely unofficial and we just wanted to experience it, which I think a lot of bands do, mainly from a viewing perspective. So we went out and we played one showcase and a few house shows that time around. And then the year after, we had one official showcase. It was a showcase through Bandpage. And then we had a few other shows on top of that. And then we took a year off. And then this year we were invited by South By to be an official band. So it was our first time as that. And, you know, I think it's just you continually work. It is a mix of like work, press, you know, buzz.
Networking.
But it's a fun festival. It really is. I mean,
well, we should explain to listeners who aren't familiar with it that it basically started out many years ago, decades ago, as a way for up and coming bands to showcase, you know, play showcases. And very often the press and the A&R record company executives would stay in one place and the bands would move around. And is it still that way?
Yes and no. I think we were actually talking about this in the car on the drive back because I had a really great time this year, I think, and I was exposed to a lot of new bands. We actually played a show with this band called Ivan and the Parasol. And they're kind of like if you took Jet, the Hives, and the Strokes and mashed them together. They're this amazing band from Hungary. But we became friends with them and they were just unbelievably amazing. And I've read a lot of tweets from big artists like, oh, it's no longer about like the smaller bands and it's become so much about the big bands. And in some regard that's true, but I also think that once you get to that level of fame where you are a big band, it's also your responsibility to, you know, help these showcases. And I don't mean by playing. I mean, if our band gets to the level that we want to, you know, get to, we still want to go back to South By as viewers and watch bands and enjoy them because things like that are also going to get those bands places. You know, I mean, if one of the members of just throwing out the Rolling Stones, if Mick Jagger was at our show, that would give us press. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there's all sorts of things. And I think the music industry is a very cyclical creature or it can be, you know, and it kind of has a pay it forward vibe sometimes. So South by Southwest is an amazing festival and it could be even better. And just like anything, there are negative attributes, but there are far more positive in my opinion.
As a band, I've been told that it can be quite grueling as well, that the number of shows you have to play, you know, upwards of 6-7 shows a day in different venues where you're setting up, you have no time to set up, you have no sound check. Is that, was that the case for you?
It is. It's very, very difficult. It's, we are lucky because the most we had in one day was 3 shows. But we are unlucky because the songs that people really want to hear in our set are the ones where I'm singing at the absolute top of my range. So, and I'm singing like extremely loud. So
a song like Beneath the Brine would be a
exactly,
perfect,
you know, yeah. Like doing Brine 3 times is just terrifying. I'm not going to lie. And we have that and we have Make Me a Boat, which also has me doing some weird, like indie singing at the very end of it. And so like you know, doing three shows in a day is, when you go up to that, you're very nervous about it and you're, you know, oh my God, it's coming, but there's also kind of an energy of like, can I do this? Can I pull this off? And you expect it. I mean, it's kind of par for the course when you're in a band. You know that South by Southwest is on your list. And at the end of the day, you know, you can complain all you want that you have six shows in a day, but if you have six shows in a day and people want to see you that much, then you should be grateful. And it's very hard work, but you know what? Like, you're also given a wonderful opportunity that a lot of people aren't. So you have to be grateful for it. You can't be negative about it. And once you do become negative about it, you should really rethink, you know, like your attitude, I think.
Well, I'm thinking of, I can't help but thinking of Fleetwood Mac and other big bands that used to be big in the old days. And they were always, people were dating each other and they break up and they still be in the band. With 100 people in your band, everybody is always dating or breaking up with somebody. How many people have you dated and broken up with in the...
Well, since my wife is in the band, that's a complicated question.
just one.
No, my wife is the flute player, Laura. And it is funny, though, because, you know, John, our bass player...
he's a dog.
He's a dog. No, his girlfriend is this beautiful opera singer named Abby, and she's in the extended family, and she actually did join first. And, you know, the fun thing about that one was I met Abby, and I knew that Abby was exactly John's type. And so I kind of planned her joining the extended family around John, because I was like, oh, we have a show and you're an opera singer, you should come sing. And she was amazing, but, you know, totally different idea of like why I did that. Let's be real. but yeah. And then, you know, Owen is dating an opera singer in the group named Leslie, who's fantastic. It's interesting. I mean, like it's hard not to meet wonderful people, when you work with wonderful people on such a close level, you know. I mean, literally, I can't stress how lucky we are, to have all these amazingly wonderful people in our lives. You know, our newest member, or one of our newest members, George, he's the youngest at 22. He's a trombone player. And he joined the band, and, you know, after 6 months, he came to me and he was like, I have never in my life met this many wonderful people at one set time. Like, I don't know how you guys have been able to like only have these really kind, amazing people in your lives, in this extended family. But you know, we're super fortunate to have them. So yeah, it's hard not to fall in love with them.
Michael, you're right. They are hippies.
And to clarify, we were all wrong. It's not thefamilycrest.com. It's not thefamilycrest.net. It's thefamilycrestfamily.com. That is the website. Is for looking at it down on the line.
Do you have a manager that's putting all of this together for you?
Yeah, we do have a woman that works with him, named Karen, and also Laura does a lot of stuff as well. But it takes the entire band to make this stuff happen. You know, there's a lot of coordination involved in doing this, and I totally invite both of you to come and join the family. I really do mean that. Whenever you feel comfortable, either singing or playing the trumpet, I'll have a solo part written for you and ready to go.
Please feel free to bury me in the back. Now, every year I go to Coachella. This year I won't be, because I'm going to see the Family Crest on March 20th in LA, and you can see them in San Francisco on March 21st or in Boise on March 23rd. They have a whole spring tour listed on their website. Now, do you have plans to try and play events like Coachella or Lollapalooza or Bonnaroo? Oh,
absolutely. I'm so anyone at Coachella or Lollapalooza or Bonnaroo, if you're listening and you want us, you know, we're obviously down to play. We love you guys. Yeah, we want to play everything. I mean, literally, when I say we want to play 365, I really mean it. You know, if our tour vehicle holds up, we will, which it's been, you know, rough lately. But if our tour vehicle holds up, we will be anywhere and everywhere. So yeah, the goal is always to just get to those festivals and keep playing larger venues.
Well, as Michael was trying to say, I certainly appreciate you being here. I know Michael does as well. We'll place links to all of your work, your website, which apparently has an ever-changing group of of domain names. I guess we could also place links to your YouTube videos, which, by the way, that you have this one YouTube video, which you would think it took, a SWAT team of crew members to put together. And it's for Love Don't Go. And
oh, yeah.
All of your videos are one takes, and this one is one take with, but, and I guess it's walking through San Francisco on one street, and the whole street changes as you're walking through it. I don't know how you did it, but it's quite remarkable.
That was the insane brain of Keith Lancaster. He's the guy that's done a lot of video work for us. And, you know, he and I were sitting in a tour bus talking about like ideas for music videos. And I came up with this one take idea, but I didn't know how to make it happen. And he brought up our friend Jose, who did Steadicam work. And it was interesting. I mean, moving a piano into a shot and then out of a shot in a 10-second period is definitely a difficult thing to do. But, you know, the craziest thing that most people don't realize is that we did that not only in one take, but in the first take. We ran through it one time, not filming it, ran through the end of it a second time, not filming it. And then when we actually filmed it the first time, it was so perfect that, and there were so many organic moments that, you know, if we tried to replicate, would have felt replicated, that we decided to keep the first take. So we didn't even do a second take. So that was all the extended family, again, just being awesome.
Well, I'll take us out on A Little Bit of Love Don't Go. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you guys so much. You're awesome.
Your heart and the weighty world that tore you apart, and you all but given up on the stone you call a heart. You're singing out, whoa, 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 whoa. Sing it out, whoa, 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 whoa.
All righty. Well, that was great of him to join us. I can't wait to be in the band.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, it's a band that when I heard their music, I went, okay, there are very few times where I hear music and I think, yeah, that band, if they can perform live, boy, they're pretty darn good. They have a sound. Churches last year was a band like that. Arcade Fire, obviously, many, many years ago. So maybe once, twice, three times a year, I'll hear a band like that. And The Family Crest is one of those bands, and I was very glad that Liam could join us to discuss what it was like to not only start a band like that, but work in music today, and then eventually make it to South by Southwest and go through what I always heard was a grueling experience.
Well, I'm sure it's fun when you're a young band on the rise. And, you know, when he talks about, he's almost embarrassed to say, hey, we want you to buy our album. But, you know, they just want to pay the rent and make music. You know, it's not like they're trying to be greedy rock stars. They just want to, you know, they want to be able to make a living and do what they love.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at a band like the Polyphonic Spree, part of the reason that they, you know, only have one or two albums and they don't tour is because there's 20 members in that band, minimum.
They lose money every time they go out on a show.
Yeah, no, and the founder of that band admits that. He said, look, the reason you don't see us is we cannot afford to carry around all these people. Not that we don't want to, it's that we can't.
And we can't afford to wait any longer for Big Deal, Big Whoop.
That's right. It is time for Big Deal, Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. This should come as no shock. Variety and Hollywood Reporter are in a dogfight. Paramount is trying to launch its major movie, Noah, but it's Variety and the Hollywood Reporter who are getting down and dirty. First, the Hollywood Reporter ran a story about test screenings of Noah and how they weren't going very well. There's a shock. No test screenings go very well, or rarely do they go very well. Then Variety ran what we believe was kind of a lame story about a fake controversy regarding Noah, which was all based on this unknown website of a guy in the South. Paramount hit back through the Hollywood Reporter, but Variety stuck to its guns. Now Variety has written a story claiming the Pope backed out of a meeting with the director and star Russell Crowe in another snub for the film.
Pope Francis doesn't like it.
Yeah, he might have a few other things to do that day, but who knows? Paramount said through the Hollywood Reporter that there was no meeting to cancel. The director wasn't going to be there, and that Crowe was in Rome promoting the movie, and they considered going for a photo op at the Pope's regularly scheduled public gathering, but the Vatican's people said a movie star would cause havoc, so they didn't go. Whatever happens to Noah, the two dailies are getting along like Cain and Abel. Get it? Get it? It's all biblical. Get it? Big deal, big whoop.
It's a big whoop, but it's fun to see a little spat into trades and one taking one side and one taking the other. The last one was so silly. The Pope rejects Noah. It's like, no, there's, you know, every week the Pope has a thing where the crowds gather and hear him give a little talk, a little homily, a little speech. There's always a little meet and greet section where the faithful and certain people can get forward and hopefully get a photo with the Pope. And he was in town already. And they were like, oh, hey, could he come by and do a photo? And they were like, well, that would, you know, it's like, again, Variety was just stirring it up to make it sound like the Pope rejected the film Noah.
Yeah, well, you
they'd certainly love him to watch it and say, I love it, the film, but that's not what happened. I don't know why an Argentinian Pope, by the way, is he Argentinian? Why an Argentinian Pope would speak with an Italian accent, though he does speak Italian fluently. I gotta check, make sure I've got the right country.
Yeah, it is Argentina. And, you know, although I probably shouldn't say that because I've been so wrong today already. what yeah, I'll say is that every Wednesday is the, you know, he comes out and does a public mass there in St. Peter's. Is it St. Peter's Square? I'm gonna get all
that's
this
right,
wrong.
That's right. Yeah, you're right. You're just fine.
And yeah. It's attended by, you know, 1 or 2 or 10,000 people. And so having Russell.
No. Yeah. Thousands and thousands. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So having Russell Crowe show up, probably not a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, in a groundbreaking deal, Warner Brothers is selling its new TV series, The 100, not to one of Canada's network channels or major cable provider, but to Netflix, Netflix Canada. So Netflix users in Canada will have access to the show only a week on a weekly basis rather than all at once, a la House of Cards. Obviously, if someone has money to spend, TV producers are willing to take it. The question is, does this help or hinder the show's prospects long term? It's currently airing on the CW here in the United States. And is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I mean, I think it's a big deal. It's a new player. Look, I mean, you had your options before of, hey, do I sell to this network or that network? And then you had a new option. What about this cable provider? What about this satellite channel? Now it's like, oh, Netflix. That's a new place you can sell your show to in a country. I mean, Netflix is getting to be all over the world. So, you know, you can make deals and suddenly you've got it in 14 countries in the blink of an eye. The question is, does this help Netflix or does this help the CW more? I'm not sure in Canada whether the reach of Netflix is remotely as good yet as it would be if it was on a major channel. So, you know, I don't know. You got to think, you maybe short term not giving you the money, but are you helping yourself long term or are you just getting more people to sign up for Netflix?
Wait, you mean Hollywood would make a bad short term decision? Well, a bad long term decision based on short term results. I've never seen that happen here in Hollywood, ever. Well, let's move on. Because even though the NFL is the only one that still even remembers performer and activist MIA appeared for 2 minutes during Madonna's halftime show back in 2011, they are suing the artist for millions of dollars. On top of the $1 million they want for her actions, they want another $15 million for the 2 minutes of exposure she received based on what an advertiser would have paid for 2 minutes of ad time during the show. They say MIA's rude gesture has tarnished their image. MIA and her lawyers make a mockery of this, comparing the $16 million fine she is being asked to pay for raising her middle finger to say a 15-yard penalty a team pays when a player says the N-word. She details rude and lascivious performances during the halftime show in the past that the NFL was aware of in advance, like Michael Jackson's, genitalia readjustment, I guess would probably
grabbing be. Grabbing his crotch.
Yes, that's what. And Prince caressing his guitar as if it were, you know, he were stroking, you know, an erect.
This is a quote from her, you know.
Yeah, stroking an erect oversized phallus. Even Madonna's performance included female dancers, some of whom may not have even been 18, thrusting their pelvises in the air in imitation of sexual intercourse and a dance one would see in a strip club. Her response is devastating and hilarious, and at this point, she should probably be praying for a trial where the media can play and replay all these videos and bring her even more attention. You know, maybe we should talk to Liam about playing at the halftime show. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. You know, there's no big repercussions for this. Though, of course, there's lawyer fees. You know, she's paying hundreds of thousands, if not into seven figures now for lawyers, because it's been going on for a while. So, you know, she needs to countersue and get her money back for this. She also brings up the point, she and her lawyers, why didn't NBC have the reasonable caution of a 5-second delay and use it if they objected? You know, because this had happened, all of this happened years after Janet Jackson had her wardrobe malfunction and exposed one of her breasts, whether intentionally or not, at the halftime show. And now, you know, the NFL's they're all in open arms about MA. I think it's ridiculous. I think they tore the NFL's things apart. They go into a lot more stuff like behavior of the players who play on teams and who are wife beaters and drug addicts and in jail and, you know, on and on. But they're valued members of the NFL team. But MIA's brief, stupid gesture is somehow tarnishing them worth tens of millions of dollars. Of course, I'll put all that aside and say she still shouldn't have done it, and it was unprofessional and silly. But hey, when you bring on an activist performer, that's what you're going to get.
Yeah, that's true. And she wasn't even the main headliner, but that's...
No. She was just in for 2 minutes rapping in the middle of one of Madonna's songs.
And you know what? Include Showbiz Sandbox as a piece of evidence, because I watched that live. I had no idea she was actually participating.
But if you freeze framed it, you could see.
No, I had no idea that she was even on stage. I didn't know who that was. I had no idea that was MIA. I mean, I know what she looks like and I know who she is, and I was very I didn't know that they were bringing her up on stage. So yeah. When one of many performers was on stage, I had no clue who that was.
Or, well, we don't care whether you knew, but you didn't see her make the gesture?
No, I did not.
No, right. Oh, well.
Now, Hachette is one of the big five, you know, in U.S. publishing. We talk about them quite a bit. And they were an early adopter of the ebook format. So their latest earnings report is not a big surprise. Ebooks are 30% of Hachette's entire revenue. Given that ebooks typically cost less than hardcover, it's likely that they're 35% or more of unit sales. This trend is expected to grow for the company. Also, the info available made clear that earnings grew more than the 6% increase in sales for that category. Did you follow all that? Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, and here's why. Here's why we're saying that. The sales increased 6% in ebooks, but the earnings grew a lot more than 6%. Why is that? Because you make bigger profit margins on ebooks. The publishers keep saying, oh, no, you're ignoring all the expensive stuff we do for books other than just printing them. It's so expensive. But in fact, they make more money off a sale of an ebook than they do off a hardcover. They have a bigger margin of profit. And, you know, in fact, you know, sometimes sales slow overall, but because ebook sales increase, they're making more money. So ebooks are, in fact, obviously more profitable than hardbooks for a range of reasons. And that's why long term it could be a good thing for the industry.
On the heels of Amazon announcing it would raise the cost of Amazon Prime membership to $100, causing Twitter to go berserk, by the way, the Wall Street Journal offered up some more details of Amazon's plans for music streaming as one of the benefits of membership. Unlike some other services, which allow unlimited playing and replaying of songs users can access, Amazon is planning to strictly limit how many times you can play any particular track. They see the streaming as more of a chance to sample the way people listen to, say, a song on SoundCloud or YouTube. If you like the song, what they really want is to push you towards buying the track or the entire album it came from. So streaming becomes a sort of, say, showcasing, like South by Southwest, rather than an ends to itself. Billboard says Amazon is offering a pool of $30 million to record labels to encourage participation, with $25 million going to the three majors, Vivendi, Universal, and Sony, with the rest for indies, which they couldn't be more happy. Great, thank you so much. $5 million you gave the rest to the big three, of course. Another chunk goes to music publishers. Amazon will pay them 21% of what they pay record labels, the same rate that Spotify and RDO use. Labels are said to be holding back on offering new releases for the streaming service, so we'll see how that works out. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. You know, the more reduced it is, the less of a competitor it's going to be for the other people. And it sounds like, and it wasn't even clear that it's saying a limited number of repeats. It might even be just a limited number of amount of each song. You know how if you go into iTunes, you can play like 30 seconds of a track?
Yes.
That might be even what they're talking about. I may not even be right that they're saying, oh, you can only replay it twice and you got to pay. It might be, no, you can only hear like 40 seconds of the song.
Which
so
would be
that
pointless.
May be what they're then thinking, who cares?
Yeah, that would be called fair use. Yeah.
And again, it's not, I don't know if it's fair use, but it's like you can practically do that on their Amazon.com website for a lot of albums. And why would the labels hold back new music if all they can do is let you play 30 seconds of a song? Because the wording is unclear. Nobody quite knows what Amazon is doing. They seem to have a lot of restrictions on it. And the more you hear about it, the less interesting it seems.
Well, once again, Amazon proves that they can try and turn everything into a cash register for more sales.
Well, that's their job.
That's true. Now, CBS is renewing 20 of the shows on its current schedule. In fact, it's quicker to list the four shows they haven't renewed yet. The Robin Williams comedy, The Crazy Ones, long-running hit The Mentalist, new ratings challenge drama Intelligence, and the yet-to-premiere Friends with Better Lives. So they've basically not even premiered it, and they've already canceled it. That's great. Since it's the number one network, and its lineup is deep, deep, very deep. They have a deep bench, as they say. It's no surprise CBS has renewed most of its shows already. Perhaps the biggest news was The Big Bang Theory, expanding on a trend we've been talking about here on Showbiz Sandbox for a while. Big Bang was renewed for not one, no, count them, three more seasons.
Wow.
Yes, the show in its seventh season has just been guaranteed a 10th season. That's what that means. So I would say big deal or big whoop, but I think we know what the answer is.
Well, yeah, I think it is a big deal. This has to be the biggest renewal for any show on network ever.
Yes.
Has there ever been a show renewed for three seasons? Now, we've had some syndicated shows or shows on cable channels get 1090 deals. Like FX had a 1090 deal with Anger Management starring Charlie Sheen and a new show with George Lopez, meaning they made 10 episodes. And if you reach certain metrics, everybody agreed, then they would make 90 more on a big batch. And so you'd be, you know, it's kind of like, in the old days, like a five-season, you know, renewal commitment all at once. So that has been happening. And now it's coming to the networks. They're saying, look, we got the Big Bang. We got this expensive cast. It's a smarter thing long-term. When you do it year by year, you're just going to end up paying more money. Everybody can be locked in. Everybody can know what they're doing. You can plan out your storylines better. And Big Bang Theory doesn't have massive arcs, but they do have people getting into relationships and maybe kids. So you want to decide, how are you going to pace that out? What are you going to do? You can plan your next 3 years emotionally. So I think it's a smart thing to do. And I think it's definitely the trend. People are renewing for 1 year. Why wait? You're Walking Dead. You think that's not going to be around for 5 years? You know, what are they waiting for? Lock them in now.
Well, this next story could have gone either way. But the Netflix series Orange is the New Black will be submitted to the Emmys as a comedy, not a drama. Is that because the creative talent involved decided that comedy was the best and most fitting genre to reflect the show they make? Or was it because Netflix didn't want Orange to compete with, say, I don't know, off the top of my head, House of Cards, their own show, in the best drama series? And is this a big deal or is this a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. I don't know why the people get to decide how to submit it. It seems like sometimes you'd want to say, no. When somebody submits something for the wrong category, you might want to take action. But when you've got a show like this, which could fall into either way, kind of like Alan McBeal or Northern Exposure, you know, hey, you know, you got to pick some category, and why not choose the one that doesn't compete with your other big hit?
That's true. Well, now, speaking of competing, that kind of concludes Big Deal, Big Whoop for this week, and moves us along into Inside Baseball. That's where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I guess, Michael, you have a bunch of news stories here about Broadway and theater and some of the shows. You were competing really against yourself. You were trying to tell us last year which shows you would or would not invest in based on whether you thought they'd kind of make their money back or be bombs. And before we get to that,
We were talking about what are going to be the big new shows of the season. And what we didn't anticipate was that the highest grossing show of the season will be one that's been on Broadway for 16 years. And that's The Lion King. The New York Times had a really good story about dynamic pricing. Dynamic pricing is when you charge more when something is more demand. It started, I think, with the airlines, where they'd say, hey, peak flight times at Thanksgiving and Christmas, guess what? We're going to charge you more money for your ticket, especially the closer you wait to travel time. And so they constantly are adjusting, and they've got, you know, massive software to know, okay, we know that 4 days out, a lot of people can decide, but one day out, if we haven't sold a ticket, we should discount, you know, crazy stuff like that. And they keep adjusting their prices and all their seats with dynamic pricing. Well, it's come to Broadway. Everybody's doing it. We got premium seats for everybody, but nobody does it the way that The Lion King does. Well, no one does it the way, to be specific, Disney.
Well, and it's a practice, this dynamic pricing that with the airlines, customers love so much that Broadway is taking it up.
Exactly. That's right.
Yeah. And so, I was being sarcastic there in case you didn't pick up on that.
Right. So what are some of the things? So, I mean, after all the years, they had faded, actually. I mean, you know, they were massive, massive hit. But as recently as 2009, they were grossing about like $800,000 a week. And now, suddenly, this year, they're grossing $1.3, $1.5 million a week. They've become more popular 5 years later. Most shows don't even run 5 years, but, you know, they've been on the boards for X number of years, and they were having that natural decline. But because of dynamic pricing, they were able to smartly boost up their weekly grosses a lot. And it wasn't just slapping a bigger ticket price on it. What are some of the things they're doing?
Well, obviously, they're increasing prices on weekends and holidays. You've already mentioned that. But if they're not charging the highest price on Broadway, and it's not even close, what are they doing?
Well, their top ticket price is $227.
Which is expensive, actually. But
it's a lot of money. But not when you look at the Book of Mormon. That's $477. That means Friday or Saturday night, especially at peak time. And frankly, there's no not peak time for Book of Mormon, not right now. But, you know, you're going to pay, if you want the best seats in the house, almost $500. And especially $500 if you add on all the extras.
And that's not through a scalper.
No, that's through them, because they're like, hey, why let the scalper charge $500? We'll charge $500. And same thing with Wicked, $300. Kinky Boots, $350. That's what those shows are charging at peak times. The Lion King is, Book of Mormon is probably more popular. I put that in quotes. It's just a much smaller house. But The Lion King is saying, no, we're not going to charge that much. Why? Why would they do that? A couple things. One, it's a family show. And yes, often a parent will come with one child, but they know more often it's going to be three or four people in a group or five people in a group. And suddenly we know maybe two people go to Book of Mormon. You're not bringing your kids to Book of Mormon, and maybe a mother daughter go to Wicked. But when you're bringing three or four people or five people, that starts to get really pricey, and you want to be smarter about what you do. Secondly, they said, hey, we don't want people to go to the show and feel, it wasn't worth $500. They want them to go and say they had a great time and tell other people to go. They're playing the long game.
Yeah,
they
want
as full a house as possible.
Disney does that quite well in most of their endeavors.
Yes. And so they're saying, all right, we want you to go. You're going to pay less money than most of the other big hit shows, and you're going to be really happy. You're going to say, we had a great time. It was good. You're not going to feel like if you pay $500 for Book of Mormon, that show better be the funniest damn show you've ever seen in your life. Right? I mean,
yeah.
My God. And it's not. Frankly, you know, it's a good show. I liked it, but by God, $500? No way. So they've said, look, we think word of mouth will be better if we don't gouge people as much as possible for that biggest ticket price. And we know it's family, so they're going to have three or four people in a group. So they're going to have $1,000, you know, charge if you bring four people to a show at $227, more than that, frankly, close to it. So, you know, it's a lot of money already. So I think they're being smart. So last year, they sold 700,000 tickets on Broadway. That's 50,000 more than they sold 5 years earlier back in 2009. Now, that was when the Depression was hitting, of course, and that's when their weekly grosses was substantially lower, $500,000 to $700,000 lower. They've almost doubled it now in some of their peak weeks now. They're up to $1.5 million a week. Dynamic pricing is everywhere, and everyone agrees no one does it better than Disney.
Well, our next story is going to be about how the workers on The Lion King are going on strike until they get raises. You know, as funny as that is, you know what isn't funny is that we talked to Liam for so long from the Family Crest. And of course, there was a reason for that. He was, you know, interesting to speak with. And I know I just teased that we would be filling you in on how Michael did on his Broadway picks on which shows he'd invest in and which shows he wouldn't invest in for last year, or was it this year for last year? I don't know. The shows that are currently on Broadway.
But so you got to wait 2 weeks since Sperling's going to be off. But in 2 weeks, come hell or high water, you're not going to book a guest.
Not going to book a guest.
You're going to chat about CinemaCon,
right,
even though it'll be a week later. And we'll talk about both how I did last year in my picks of what shows would be hits and how I'm going to do this year, because we'll look at the new shows coming out, and that'll give me a chance. I'm seeing Rocky on Wednesday. I'm seeing Aladdin next Tuesday. And so I'll be more informed about some of the big new shows, and we'll tell you what we think.
You know, I'm such a windbag today that I can't even beg off and tease what we're going to do in 2 weeks properly. You had to come in and save me.
Well, that's what I'm here for.
Well, again,
in a world where a podcaster's lost. All right.
Well, on that note, I wanted to remind everybody to subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, Google Play Store, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Please do subscribe to the show, rate, review the show. It does help us out. I'd like to thank our guest, Liam McCormick from the Family Crest. We're going to place tons of links in our show notes to his to all of the band's, their work, their video work, their albums, their, I mean, I don't know if we'll have enough room for all the links that we'll have to place there. But links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find all those ways to email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we're on Twitter, where our username is showbizsandbox. You can search for us on Facebook, where our username is also showbizsandbox, and you can like our page there. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT, who the Family Crest covers on one of their YouTube videos, I might add. But MGMT can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it changes. This week it is...
I'minthefamily2.com.
Okay, a reference to the Family Crest. Now, if you can't find Michael's writing on that particular website, try searching for michaelgiltz.com, or you can read some of his writing on entertainment over at the Huffington Post. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.